Good day, and welcome to the American Constitution Society, What's Next, Greenhouse Gas and the Environmental Regulation After the 2013 Term Conference Call. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Sarah Knight. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Good afternoon. I'm Sarah Knight, Vice President of Network Advancement here at the American Constitution Society. Thank you for joining today's call, What's Next, Greenhouse Gas and Environmental Regulation After the 2013 Term. Please note that today's call is being recorded. We'll provide the recording to those who RSVP'd after the call, and it will also be available on our website. This is the third in our summer series of What's Next calls, where experts in our network discuss the past U.S. Supreme Court term. 0.5 California CLE credit is available for this and all of the calls in the series. Please email Katie O'Connor at kocconnor@acslaw.org to get credit. We will invite you to ask questions at the end of the call. Judging from the RSVP list, we'd like to say welcome to several new friends to the American Constitution Society. For those of you not familiar with ACS, we are a national network of lawyers, scholars, law students, judges, and policymakers who believe that the law should be a force to improve the lives of all people. ACS works for positive change by shaping debate on vitally important legal and constitutional issues through the development of and promotion of high-impact ideas. If you support these efforts and are not a formal part of our network, I encourage you to become a national member of ACS today. It's now my pleasure to introduce Gerald Torres, currently Jane M.G. Foster Professor of Law at Cornell University Law School, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General for the Environment and Natural Resources Division of the U.S. Department of Justice and advisor to then-Attorney General Janet Reno. Gerald sits on the boards of the Earth Day Network and the Natural Resources Defense Council. His scholarly interests include not only environmental law, but also federal Indian law and critical race theory. In 2004, he was honored with a Legal Service Award from the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund for his work to advance the legal rights of Latinos. As that short biography demonstrates, Gerald is uniquely able to observe and talk about the connections between what happens on the court's environmental docket and what happens in other areas of law important to ACS members. I'm excited to hear what he has to tell us today, and with that, I'll turn it over to Gerald.
Thank you. What I want to talk about today, and I'll talk for just 15 or 20 minutes and then open it up for questions, is really what the term presages for the environmental conflicts that are emerging, especially the conflict over climate instability and greenhouse gases. A couple of years ago, the Supreme Court decided a case called Massachusetts against EPA, and that was a critically important case, certainly important for the Utilities Air Regulation Group case this term, because it enabled or recognized that regulating greenhouse gases was within the ambit of EPA and under the Clean Air Act. And so once regulating greenhouse gases was understood to be part of what the EPA can do under the Clean Air Act, the only question is then, how's it going to do it? How's it going to incorporate a regulatory structure within the regulatory structure of the Clean Air Act, the reduction or monitoring and regulation of greenhouse gases? Of course, greenhouse gases and the regulation of greenhouse gases is not only critically important, but difficult and implicates a wide cross-section of industry, especially the power industry. And because it implicates the power industry, it also implicates power usage of all other industries, so that you can imagine, as the case, the Utilities Air Regulation Group case was going forward, it was joined by major business groups who were concerned that the attempt to regulate greenhouse gases under the PSD program, Prevention of Significant Deterioration program, would be costly and unwieldy. And so that was the way the case was kind of of teed up. And I'll talk about the case in a minute, and I hope to talk a little bit about the plan that President Obama unveiled at the beginning of June. But I also want to put it in the context of the Clean Air Act and its federalism mandate, because what these cases, just like in many ways the Affordable Care Act, what these cases and regulation of greenhouse gas put in front of us is what is the model of federalism going forward. And of course, anybody concerned about the structure of national governance is going to be engaged with, and the Constitution, of course, is going to be engaged with federalism, which is at the heart of the Constitution in many ways. So the structural Constitution, anyway. So with that, let me talk a little bit first about the Clean Air Act, and then about the case specifically, and then about President Obama's, or I should say EPA's proposed clean power plan. For those, most everybody on the call, I assume, is familiar with the environmental regulation and certainly the Clean Air Act in general, but I just wanted to stress a couple of things about it. First, it's important to recognize, and the court recognized this in Massachusetts, that the Clean Air Act is a health-based statute. That is, the standards for regulation in the Clean Air Act are largely pivot around the question of human health and safety. So that once the question of greenhouse gases is, or any other pollutant is put before the EPA, what EPA has got to do is to, using cost-sensitive but health-driven standards to craft the regulations. Second, the Clean Air Act really does rely on driving technology to achieve the results. Driving technology to achieve the results just means that it actually ought to, in its best form, spur innovation. And so that's I think, really important. So that the Clean Air Act then can be thought of as a pollution reduction statute that is consistent with both the health-based priority and the capacity of the regulatory regime to produce technological change. And both of those are designed then to reduce the role that air pollutants play in the endangerment of human health. Now, having said that, one of the critical features of the Clean Air Act is that it's not, well, it is, it sets national standards. It's really centered for enforcement and implementation on the states. So it does have in mind, and I hesitate to use this term because it's freighted in the literature already, but it's designed to produce a kind of cooperative federalism. Now, I recognize that saying cooperative federalism itself raises a variety of issues, but they, in my view, they have to be answered concretely, and they really have to be answered by reference to what questions you're trying to answer. So, to me, the question I'd like to put in the back of this before I talk about the case is, what is federalism for? And my view is, and I think the view of many people, right, is that the federalism, especially cooperative or uncooperative federalism, or however people want to term it these days, but the object of federalism is to produce a better functioning or a well-functioning democratic republic, and that's I think the long and short of it. Okay, so let's talk about the Utilities Air Regulation Group case. What they were trying to do in that case was to figure out whether the Prevention of Significant Deterioration title of the Clean Air Act gave EPA the authority to regulate greenhouse gases. The short answer is that despite the language in the Act and the Massachusetts against EPA case, it suggested that the regulation of all air pollutants was had different meanings throughout the statute, and they had to be read contextually, and they had to be read in relationship to the specific sections of the Clean Air Act. And reading it that way, the court essentially decided that EPA was attempting to redraft the Clean Air Act to cover greenhouse gases within the PSD section, and that wouldn't be reasonable for a number of reasons. One, because of the understanding the language of the Act as it was interpreted, or as it ought to be interpreted in the PSD section, and because of the EPA's own discussion of the regulatory difficulties and complications that it would produce. Now, having said that, the court went on to say that EPA could impose greenhouse gas regulations on facilities that were already covered by another part of the Clean Air Act, so that if a source is already covered and regulated under the best available control technology, then they could use that regulatory section to cover greenhouse gases. So that it was, you know, it was a win for EPA and the administration, but not a complete win, because it does further reinforce the conclusion in Massachusetts that greenhouse gases are a regulable pollutant under the Clean Air Act, but it also then drew some lines around how or what regulatory sections the EPA can use to regulate greenhouse gases. The obvious question that it leaves for us is what is the impact of this ruling going to be on the clean power plan that was announced by EPA and President Obama. Now, the Clean Power Plan is in some ways it is a classic example of using the tools available in the Clean Air Act to get a hold of a problem that most everyone recognizes is critically important to human health and safety, and that's regulating greenhouse gases. And the object is to cut greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants by 30% from the 2005 level by 2030. Now, this case, the UARG case that I was just talking about, it gives some support to people who think the plan is a valid exercise of EPA jurisdiction, and it'll give some support to those people who think that EPA may be overreaching. I think it does mean there's going to be litigation over the Clean Power Plan, and it is going to in some ways, while not triggering the same kinds of constitutional objection, is going to raise questions of federalism, because the Clean Power Plan, like the rest of the Clean Air Act, really does create some targets and then say to the states, this is what we want you to achieve. We're not going to tell you how to achieve it, we want you to produce a plan that will demonstrate that you can reach those greenhouse gas reduction targets by the deadlines set in the proposed rule. Now, the plan is obviously quite detailed, but if you look at it, it gives the states a number of tools to achieve the reductions, and it gives a couple of ways for the states to measure reductions. They can measure reductions by carbon intensity, right, the amount of carbon used per unit of power generation, or they can use a mass-based goal of an equivalent pollutant, that is the number of tons of carbon reduced overall. And what the Clean Power Plan aims to do within the structure of the Clean Air Act is, one, to make coal power plants more efficient, two, to make gas plants more efficient, that is to make them more efficient generation of electricity, to increase renewables and nuclear energy, and then finally to reduce the amount of energy that's used by endpoint users. And all of those tools taken together will, at least the EPA proposes, that it will reduce the greenhouse gas levels from existing power plants to 30% of the 2005 level. Now, we can, you know, talk in more detail about the various mix that the plan sets up. But what we can do is we can say, you know, what we've done here, what the Clean Power Plan and the UARG case do is they reaffirm the structure of the Clean Air Act. They reaffirm the authority of the EPA within this federal idea of pollution regulation to achieve health-based standards and to set goals for the states to achieve and to monitor the states' progress towards the achievement without telling the states how to do it. Now, the difficulty, of course, will be that there was a dissent in the UARG case, which suggested that Massachusetts against EPA is wrong because the Clean Air Act is unsuited for regulating greenhouse gases. And I suspect, even though it was a dissent, I suspect a lot of the contention is going to arise over just that question. Both whether the greenhouse gases are fit to be regulated under the Clean Air Act, or whether the EPA has the authority under Section 111D of the Clean Air Act to impose the requirements on the states to achieve greenhouse gas reductions consistent with the health-based mandate, because a lot of the question is, you know, what is the, you know, what are the health-based consequences of not reducing greenhouse gases, and second, it really is a more national standard because the reduction of greenhouse gases is a global issue, and it's really an attempt to tie the states into the adoption of programs that they would not otherwise adopt for themselves, and so I think that's a snapshot of where we are, and I don't know if that's enough for now, but I'd be happy to take any questions and listen to your comments and maybe respond myself. So let's leave it there and go forward.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing *1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Again, press *1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for questions. We'll take our first question from Howard Wayne with the California Attorney General's Office.
Thank you. My question is, what is the basis for the position that greenhouse gas reduction falls within the health-based standards of the Clean Air Act?
Well, the basis for determining that greenhouse gases fall within the health-based standard of the Clean Air Act are two. One, relying on the Supreme Court's decision in Massachusetts against EPA, they found that the authority of EPA to regulate pollutants covered greenhouse gases. And EPA has so far estimated that the reduction of greenhouse gases will not just make energy plants more efficient in terms of greenhouse gases, but it will drive reduction of other pollutants as well, so that there'll be a net savings, and the health-based justification is rooted in the science related to climate instability and the costs associated in human health, costs associated with climate instability, as well as the collateral benefits by reducing greenhouse gas, the collateral benefits of pollution reduction by targeting greenhouse gases.
We'll go next to Matt Brill with the American Constitution Society.
Hi, I was wondering if you mentioned the Clean Power Plan, but if there were other significant legal challenges to environmental regulation generally and any cases that might come up at the next term of the Supreme Court that we should be on the lookout for.
I actually hadn't thought about that yet. I mean, I have to say, and this is a form of confession avoidance, I concede, my main focus recently has been water, which is, of course, largely state-driven. But I think the efforts in terms of what's going to drive a lot of the litigation, it's going to be largely driven both by the clean water, the new water of the United States rule. So we'll get some water litigation, but also this is going to be the thing that's going to drive a lot of the litigation. What's interesting as well, and I don't know if it's going to come up in the next term, but I think one of the things that's going to emerge is our challenges to some of the toxics regulations. That will come up in the context of free trade, some of the free trade plans that are being proposed. So, I mean, there's a wide range of issues that are quite important to human health that are percolating, and I know that's a water pun, I didn't mean it, percolating through the system. But I would look at the clean water rule, the waters of the United States, those rules, and the challenges to the regulatory reach under the Clean Water Act, as well as the continued challenges to the regulatory reach under the Clean Air Act, and then the impact of trade regulations on a variety of environmental regulations, but probably specifically toxics.
Once again, if you have a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. We'll go next to Sean Wright with the Center for American Progress.
Hi, thank you for speaking with us today. I wondered if you could touch on the other significant Clean Air Act case of the term, the EME Homer decision, and if you see any sort of interesting decision or kind of discussion between the justices on interpreting other ambiguous parts of the statute and how that might impact the Clean Power Rule. Thanks.
I'm sorry, I couldn't quite, it was a little, you were a little fuzzy, so I couldn't quite hear the last part of the question.
Oh, sorry. I was just asking if you could touch on the other big Clean Air Act case of the term EME Homer, and if you see any interesting kind of takeaways from how the justices were reviewing ambiguity under the cross-state air rule, which has kind of a not global but national impact, how that might impact their review of the Clean Power Rule.
Well, you know, I think it will be the question of whether the Clean Power Rule is within the regulatory reach of EPA because of the cross-state. Let me step back. Because the regulation and reduction of greenhouse gases is not something that any single state can do. So that a lot of the capacity to achieve the compliance is going to be problematic. I actually don't think, though, that ultimately it's going to be an impediment, largely because I think that the plan, the power plan as it's presently constructed, and the EME Homer case permit the EPA to work out with the states an implementation plan, and there is an interim as well as a final trigger in the Clean Power Plan, so that the states will have a chance both to meet an interim goal and then the final goal. And my suspicion is that there'll be some negotiation, vertical as well as horizontal negotiation, consistent with both the EME Homer and the power plan. That means that it will figure in some of the conflict, but I don't think it's going to be driving it.
At this time, we have one question remaining in the queue. Once again, if you would like to ask a question or have a follow-up question, please press star 1. We'll take our next question from Carrie Miller.
Right. So although the Supreme Court declined to revisit the questions of whether greenhouse gases are air pollutants and whether the EPA's determination that greenhouse gases endanger public health, whether that's a proper determination, you mentioned in the call earlier that the dissent seemed to suggest that Massachusetts versus EPA was wrongly decided.
Right.
I'm just wondering if you think the court might hear challenges or if there's any sort of danger to that being overturned in the future.
Well, there were only two dissenters, but I think, what you may hear, certainly I suspect there's going to be some legislative action that this may trigger. If there's going to be any legislative action, I don't know, Congress will act. But it does give some solace to those people who think that greenhouse gases ought to be regulated in a different way. It also does, give some solace to those people who think that the interpretation of any air pollutant under the Massachusetts against EPA is so broad that it gives a kind of unfettered power to EPA. Now, having said that, I think Justice Scalia's analysis and his argument, his opinion, I'm sorry, his analysis there suggests that the justices were going to read the language of the Clean Air Act in a way that is consistent with its understanding of EPA's power under the Clean Air Act. So despite the authority under Massachusetts, what I think this case does is to suggest that EPA has got to be very careful in tailoring the rules to implement the regulation of greenhouse gases, and that if their interpretation is found to be unreasonable, since remember that's the first step in analysis of the rule for the court, that they will be given deference only to the extent that their interpretation is reasonable. And I think if you read the majority opinion, it suggests a variety of ways in which overreaching by the EPA is really going to be monitored because through the lens of whether the interpretation of the language of the Act consistent with the science of greenhouse gas regulation is reasonable. And I think that's where a lot of the action is going to be.
Once again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. It appears there are no further questions at this time.
Great.
Ms. Knight, I'll turn the conference back to you for any additional remarks.
So many thanks to Gerald and all the participants for joining us on today's call. If you haven't RSVP'd for future calls, please do so. The next call in the series is next week. It'll be on Tuesday, July 22nd at 4 p.m. Eastern, and we will host What's Next, Harris v. Quinn and Its Impact on Workers, featuring Judy Scott, General Counsel of the SEIU, Service Employees International Union, and a member of the ACS Board of Directors. You will not want to miss her. We have also got several more calls this month on the Fourth Amendment and on campaign finance reform and the McCutcheon decision. I hope you'll join us for each of those calls, and please join me in thanking Gerald for that very informative update on environmental regulation after this term. Thank you, and this concludes our call.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the chance to talk to you all. Take care.
This concludes today's conference. Thank you for your participation.